While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Hello, good afternoon to you, Namibia, and to all our faithful listeners tuning in from all corners of the country and beyond. Thank you for joining us on Eagle FM, the station where conversations count. I am your host, Nafa Happy Juju, and you are listening to On the Reading News Analysis, your weekday deep dive in the stories shaping Namibia's economic, social, and governance landscape. Now, it's Tuesday, the 18th of November, 2025, and the time is 5 minutes past the hour, 1300 hours. Now, as we move further into the week, we continue to unpack the developments shaping our nation, from key decisions influencing economic growth to the lived experiences of communities across Namibia. Now, right here on the Reader, we look beyond the headlines. We examine the context, interrogate the issues, and connect the dots to bring you balanced, evidence-based insights into the forces driving Namibia's present and defining its future. Every weekday from 1300 hours to 1430, we bring you the country's most important conversations through expert interviews, in-depth analysis, archived reflections, and your voices that keep our national dialogue alive. Now, because in an age of rapid information flow, understanding remains our strongest foundation. So as we bring you today's program, we will spotlight the major national stories unfolding right now, explore their broader implications, and engage with the people shaping policy, innovation, and governance across Namibia. Now, remember, you can tune in on the Reader News Analysis on all Eagle FM frequencies, stream us live on the Eagle FM app, or join in a conversation on our WhatsApp channel. Remember, you can also to listen to Eagle FM via the Eagle FM website. Now, follow the WhatsApp channel where we share exclusive clips, insights, and behind-the-scenes moment. Now, wherever you're listening from, your office, your vehicle, or the comfort of your home, stay tuned and stay hopeful. Also, stay curious, because right here on the Reader, Namibia doesn't just listen, Namibia comes to think. Let's get right into these top stories. The Ministry of Health and Social Services today officially launched the World Antimicrobial Resistance, also known as AMR Awareness Week of 2025, marking the start of a nationwide campaign to strengthen public understanding of antimicrobial resistance and promote responsible use of antibiotics and other antimicrobial medicines. Now, World Antimicrobial Resistance Awareness Week, which is observed globally from the 18th to the 24th of November, aims to highlight the increasing threat posed by drug-resistant infections, a challenge that affects human health, animal health, agriculture, and the environment. Now, speaking at the launch, health officials emphasized that antimicrobial resistance is one of the most urgent public health threats of our time. Now, when bacteria, viruses, or fungi and parasites become resistant to medicines, the treatments that once cured infections become ineffective. This leads to longer illnesses, higher medical costs, and increased risk of death. Healthcare workers are at the forefront of the fight. Proper antibiotic stewardship, including prescribing the right medicine at the right dose and only when necessary, is essential to solving resistance. Antimicrobial resistant awareness also helps clinicians to detect resistant infections faster, implement effective infection prevention and control measures, protect vulnerable patients in hospitals and clinics, and reduce the spread of untreatable diseases within the healthcare settings. For the public, understanding antimicrobial resistance is equally crucial. Misuse and overuse of antibiotics, such as not completing prescribed doses, taking leftover medication, or using antibiotics to treat viral infections like colds and flu can accelerate resistance. Raising awareness helps communities to use antimicrobials responsibly, practice better hygiene to prevent infections, seek proper medical advice instead of self-medicating, and also protect household members, especially children and the elderly. Now, officials added that Namibia, like many countries, is already seeing the effects of rising resistance. Strengthening awareness among the public health professionals, farmers and pharmacists is key to safeguarding effective treatment options for future generations. Now, the ministry will roll out a series of activities throughout the week, including public education campaigns that are all focused on promoting the theme of preventing antimicrobial resistance altogether. Now, speaking at the event ceremony today held at Protea Hotel, on behalf of Diapokingi Tuamata, the executive director of the Ministry of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform, is Maggie Hausiku, who spoke on the importance of collaboration of all stakeholders, ministries and stakeholders such as the WHO, that is the World Health Organization, and the FAO, all to work together, the ministries to work together in order to help combat antimicrobial resistance, whether in animals or the people. Let's take a listen to Maggie Hausiku.
And an honor to join you today for the launch of the World Antimicrobial Resistance Awareness Week and the introduction of the terms of references that will guide our National AMR Steering Committee. Since 2022, we have been commemorating World AMR Week from the 18th to the 24th of November in collaboration with our key ministries, demonstrating our sustained and united commitment to this important cause. This occasion is not merely symbolic, rather it's a strategic milestone. It represents our collective commitment to safeguard the health of our people, animals, and environment. The global theme for this year's commemoration reminds us that the antimicrobial resistance is an escalating threat that transcends borders, species, and sectors. Namibia is no exception. As a livestock producing country with expanding fisheries and aquaculture sectors, as well as complex interactions among our crops and other food producing chains, the use of antimicrobials in animals and plants directly affect human health and impacts the environment. From the perspective of agriculture, fisheries, water, and land reform, we acknowledge that AMR poses a significant threat and risk to animal health and production. It threatens food safety, trade, and the livelihood of both smallholder and commercial farmers. In aquaculture and fisheries, the misuse and overuse of antimicrobials can jeopardize the sustainability of these sectors and introduce resistant organisms subsequently affecting public health. For this reason, the ministry firmly supports the One Health approach and outlines in Namibia's One Health strategy, which was launched in 2024. This strategy underscores the deep interconnectedness between the health of human, animals, plants, and the environment. Today's event demonstrates our continued commitment to turning this strategy into coordinated and practical actions. Ladies and gentlemen, by endorsing these terms of reference for the National AMR Steering Committee, we establish a mechanism that will enhance coordination and strengthen the implementation of our National Action Plan on AMR. The Steering Committee will promote collaboration across ministries, facilitate streamlined decision-making, and ensure that policies are grounded in scientific evidence. It will also help Namibia meet international standards and maintain the trust of trading partners who expect resilient antimicrobial stewardship across relevant sectors. Allow me to emphasize several priorities for the animal and agricultural sector. Number one, promoting the prudent use of antimicrobial in terrestrial and aquatic animals. Our efforts will continue to focus on strengthening guidelines, raising awareness, and ensuring compliance from industry and farmers to reduce unnecessary use of antimicrobials in the livestock and aquaculture sectors. Number two would be strengthening surveillance and fostering research. Monitoring antimicrobial use and resistance in animals, food products, and the environment is essential. We continue to encourage active participation in local, regional, and global initiatives to foster research and innovation, along with leveraging partnerships to bring solutions to scale. Transparent data sharing amongst the sectors will enable us to track trends and tailor make interventions more effectively. Number three, we also aim to improve biosecurity.
You've leveled up in life, and now it's time to level up your contact. MTC is changing the game with our new contract data plans. More data, more voice minutes, and more SMSs. Core of everything you need. Plans start from just $199 per month. And for a limited new customer's score, an extra 10 gigabytes of data valid for 90 days, absolutely free. Don't wait. Visit any MTC mobile home or call 1-2-000 to level up today. MTC, make the connection.
Okay, continuing with Maggie Hausiko.
Our efforts will continue to focus on strengthening guidelines, raising awareness, and ensuring compliance from industry and farmers to reduce unnecessary use of antimicrobials in the livestock and aquaculture sectors. Number two would be strengthening surveillance and fostering research. Monitoring antimicrobial use and resistance in animals, food products, and the environment is essential. We continue to encourage active participation in local, regional, and global initiatives to foster research and innovation, along with leveraging partnerships to bring solutions to scale. Transparent data sharing amongst the sectors will enable us to track trends and take. Number three, we also aim to improve biosecurity and disease prevention. By preventing disease outbreak in animals, we reduce the need for antimicrobials. Therefore, strong husbandry practices, vaccination programs, hygiene production systems, and responsible water management remains the core function to achieve this output. And fourthly, supporting farmers and producers. AMR is not only a technical issue, it's a livelihood issue. Our farmers need practical guidance, training, and awareness on alternatives to antimicrobial use, such as vaccines, biosecurity measures, and improved management tools. Finally, safeguard Namibia's natural resources. Responsible waste management, protection and water sources, and prevention of soil and ecosystem contamination are critical to controlling the spread of resistant organisms. Colleagues, partners, and relevant stakeholders, the responsibility to address AMR is shared. It involves every sector at every level, from policymakers to farmers, health workers to veterinarians, researchers to communities. All must play their role. I wish to acknowledge and celebrate the long-standing commitment and collaboration between our key ministries and development partners, academic institutions, and all stakeholders contributing to this agenda. Your continued support strengthens our resilience and preparedness. As we observe this year's World AMR Awareness Week, I encourage all of us to intensify our efforts not only during this week, but throughout the year. Let us remain vigilant, coordinated, and innovative. Let us continue to safeguard the effectiveness of antimicrobials so they remain life-saving tools well into the future. In closing, let us remember that we are here today striving for the better implementation of our AMR National Action Plan, both by the adoption of the TORs for the Steering Committee as well as the opening of the AMR Awareness Week. Thank you, Ministry of Health and Social Services, for making this event possible. I wish us all the best in this endeavor, in our deliberations today, during this Awareness Week, and there on forth. I thank you.
And then we had it from Maggie Hausiku. She's speaking on behalf of Executive Director of the Ministry of Water, Agriculture, Water and Land Reform, and that is in the Apukini Tuamata. Now, this year's World Antimicrobial Awareness Week theme, Handle Antibiotics with Care, highlights the urgent need to protect antibiotics today in order to ensure that they remain effective tomorrow. The theme calls for responsible use of this medicine at every level of society. Now, what Handle Antibiotics with Care entails is that it entails, one, using antibiotics when prescribed by a qualified healthcare professional, as antibiotics do not cure viral illnesses such as colds, flu, and most coughs. Misusing them for those conditions accelerates resistance. Now, in this particular aspect, it's not only the patients themselves who are guilty by perhaps self-medicating themselves, where perhaps they would had gone to a hospital or perhaps bought medicine over the counter, or antibiotics to be specific, over the counter. And when they have a flu or cold, or the child has a flu or cold, they then give it to themselves. Rather, also healthcare workers and healthcare practitioners are also guilty in this aspect, because I've heard healthcare workers complain about their colleagues giving antibiotics for viruses that do not obviously require antibiotics, such as colds and flus and coughs. I don't know whether it's something that sometimes is given by mistake, or how one does that, because obviously then it causes resistance to the drug, causes resistance to the antibiotic. And when a cause for antibiotic actually occurs, and then antibiotics are administered or prescribed to a particular patient, then there's resistance because it was administered for the wrong disease, or for the wrong illness, or the wrong virus in the first place. Now, another important aspect is completing the full course of treatment. Stopping treatment early of antibiotics, or even when symptoms improve, allows the surviving bacteria to strengthen and become resistant. Now, it's quite very important for parents and for children themselves, who are obviously perhaps much more wiser, the maybe from age 12 to 15, the in other ages, to ensure that they complete their course of treatment when prescribed antibiotics. Now, there are times where antibiotics are prescribed for, say, 7 days, use within 7 days, and after 7 days, discarded. It's very important to take those antibiotics as prescribed. And even if there is improvement in the symptoms, or there is improvement in how the one is feeling, whether it's a child or an adult, it's very noteworthy to finish the course of treatment of antibiotics, because failure to complete the course of antibiotics allows surviving bacteria to strengthen and then become resistant to whatsoever antibacterial drugs you offer then after. Also, it is not allowed to share or reuse antibiotics. Sharing leftover medication or using antibiotics prescribed for someone else can be dangerous and ineffective as well. Hence why it's quite important to stick to one's prescribed antibiotics and not share antibiotics even between children. Also promoting infection prevention and control. Simple measures such as hand washing, safe food preparation, preparing food in a safe manner, and vaccination help drastically reduce infections and limit antibiotic use. Now, we've had terminologies of food poisoning, and I don't know if I have established this before right here on the reading use analysis, to say that it's food poisoning doesn't necessarily always mean that somebody came and put some poison in your food, but rather food can become poisonous in the way we negligently prepare it. If we prepare it unsafely, then it become also food poisoning. One particular food that can go bad very easily and become a poisonous food is rice. Where we store rice, the way we prepare rice can cause it to become very poisonous in a very short period of time. And that also then increases. That helps when you curb, when you prepare food in an appropriate manner, you now curb infections and also reduce the use of antibiotics in that aspect. Hence the saying, prevention is better than cure. Responsible antibiotic use in animals and agriculture. Livestock and poultry farmers are very much encouraged to avoid routine antibiotic use for growth promotion and instead focus on improved hygiene, vaccination, and veterinary oversight. That's why the Ministry of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform engages in trying to educate farmers to safeguard their animals, and also when certain animals have been vaccinated, there is also what we call a window period, whereby that animal is not supposed to be slaughtered for consumption in a particular period of time. Because if it is, if an animal is unhealthy and then gets vaccinated, and the farmer goes on to slaughter it for consumption, that animal, that bacteria that's in the on that animal, regardless that the vaccination took place maybe two, three days ago, that bacteria becomes part. It is on the steak, on the meat that you're going to eat, and that is how bacteria are introduced from animals to human beings. Things that could be avoided if the farmers themselves, poultry farmers themselves, livestock farmers themselves, pay very close attention and educate themselves on antibiotic use for growth promotion. It's not allowed. Rather, they should focus on improved hygiene and, of course, feeding their livestock with the necessary food that they require, and also for taking their livestock for veterinary oversight and asking questions and learning when necessary to avoid certain measures. Also, another aspect that was discussed at the event was to strengthen surveillance and data collection. Now, healthcare facilities are asked, with this year's task as it was being discussed, to track prescription patterns, resistant infections, and treatment outcomes in order to guide evidence-based interventions. This is quite important so that there can be tangible results that whether it's the ministry or the stakeholders that are involved can be able to rely on to say the reason why we're bringing up this is because of this particular evidence-based intervention. So this calls for a collective call to action. So the launch of the World Antimicrobial Resistance Awareness Week of 2025 reiterates that everyone has a role to play in protecting antibiotics. Without urgent action, Namibia, like the rest of the world, risks entering a post-antibiotic era where minor infections and routine medical procedures become life-threatening. Now, through awareness, responsible practices, and cross-sector collaboration, such as the ministry says, Namibia can safeguard the effectiveness of antibiotics for future generations. Now, some of the things can be avoided since corona has now sort of to say no longer with among us or is gone, we become very reluctant in being cautious in terms of hygiene and cleanliness. Back then, you would enter a public toilet and there is no way you wouldn't find hand washing soap for you to be able to wash your hands. But now that's something that is it become rigging behind. They are no longer available. Hand sanitizers, talk even less of hand sanitizers, are no longer made available. And I think it's things like that which happened in 2020 that really woke us to being vigilant and to being aware that we can easily transfer bacteria from one person to the next. We easily transfer bacteria among ourselves, and hence why you find people with flus and coughs and all that kind of stuff passing on to the next. But this is stuff that are actually very preventable if we pay attention to them. It's something that was spoken of to say, let's put in the effort at home to ensure that we really do play our part in that regard. So it's something that's quite of importance. Now, for now, let's take a listen to Mr. Fernande Mapopi. He is the officer in charge at the FAO.
Health partners in launching the 2025 World Antimicrobial Resistance Awareness Week. Wow. Each year from 18 to 24 November, the global community gathers to raise awareness on antimicrobial resistance and an urgent and growing threat that endangers our health systems, our food systems, and the very foundation of sustainable development. Namibia has been part of this global effort since 2021, demonstrating continued commitment to safeguarding people, animals, plants, and the environment from the dangers of AMR. This year's theme, Act Now, Protect Our Present, Secure Our Future, is a powerful reminder that AMR is no longer a distant challenge. It is a present reality. Drug-resistant infections are compromising our ability to treat everyday illnesses, threatening food security and placing a heavy burden on health and veterinary services. Without urgent and coordinated action, the progress we have made as a country and as a global community is at risk. If we don't take action today, there will be no cure tomorrow. And if we don't contain AMR now, we may lose modern medicine. Ladies and gentlemen, at the heart of this campaign is the One Health approach, which recognizes that the health of people, animals, and the environment is interconnected. AMR cannot be addressed in isolation. It requires collaboration across sectors. Stronger surveillance, responsible use of antimicrobials, and improved infection prevention practices and investment in awareness and behavioral change. FAO is supporting efforts to contain AMR through our action plan 2021 to 2025. And through this action, FAO is supporting countries to develop their national action plan, as well as with implementation, creating awareness among farmers and fishers for the responsible use of antimicrobials, as well as strengthening the systems to track antimicrobial resistance. We therefore commend the Minister of Health and Social Services, the Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform, and then the Minister of Environment, Forestry and Tourism, and all partners, including the Namibian Institute of Pathology, and all other stakeholders, WHO, World Organization of Animal Health, and many others for continuing to champion this multi-sectoral effort. FAO remains fully committed to supporting Namibia's AMR response through our technical assistance, capacity development programs, and ongoing support to surveillance and stewardship in the agriculture and food sectors. FAO will continue with working with the government and partners to reduce the emergency and spread of resistant pathogens, protecting the effectiveness of antimicrobials. Is not only essential for animal health and productivity, but also for food safety, trade, livelihood, and rural development. Furthermore, this year's AMR campaign strongly aligns with FAO's vision for the four betas. Those are betas in the our strategic framework 2022 to 2031, which is better production, better nutrition, a better environment, and better life for all, leaving no one behind. And in the context of these betas, by raising awareness and promoting responsible antimicrobial use in health, livestock and environment, we are contributing to the better production through safer, more sustainable farming systems that reduce antimicrobial misuse while protecting animal health and market access. We are also supporting better nutrition as reducing AMR ensures that the food remains safe and free from drug-resistant pathogens, safeguarding the health of consumers and protecting the nutritional value of animal sourced foods that remain vital in the Namibian diets. Through our One Health approach, the campaign advances better environment by promoting practices that prevent antimicrobial residues from entering the soil and water systems, protecting ecosystems and strengthening climate resilience. And most importantly, it drives better life, ensuring that communities, especially in rural Namibia, are healthier, more informed, and less vulnerable to the economic and health shocks caused by drug-resistant infections. In this way, World AMR Awareness Week becomes more than a campaign. It is a step towards a more resilient, sustainable, and inclusive future for all Namibians. Today's launch also marks an important milestone with the introduction of Clinta, the AMR warrior, a mascot that will help strengthen public engagement and make AMR message more accessible, especially to children, young people, and communities. This is an innovative step that reflects Namibia's commitment to ensuring AMR awareness reaches every corner of the society. In conclusion, as we embark on this year's WOW, activities from, we are used to acronyms, World AMR Awareness Week. Activities from community outreach and school engagement to media campaigns and stakeholders events, let us remember that action begins with each one of us. Healthy workers by prescribing responsibly, farmers by using antimicrobial prudently, policymakers by strengthening, regulating and coordination, communities by practicing good hygiene and seeking appropriate care. Together, we can protect the present and secure a healthier, safer future. Farmer looks forward to continuing this partnership and supporting Namibia in building resilient, sustainable, and safe food and health systems. I wish you all a successful 2025 World Antimicrobial Week campaign. I think.
And that's the voice of Ferdinanda Mapopi, who is the officer in charge at the FAO. And our short education on drug resistance or TB drug resistance as we talk about antimicrobial resistance week. But before that, let's pause here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM,
The Eye.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, The Eye.
Welcome back. Now a short informative education on drug resistance or TB drug resistance. Now, TB drug resistance develops when microbacteria tuberculosis or becomes drug resistant when the bacteria that causes TB change, which is microbacteria tuberculosis, mutates or no longer responds to the medicines that are designed to kill it or to combat it. Now, the common forms are MDR-TB, which is known as multi-drug resistant TB, which is resistant to at least isoniazid and rifampicin, CDRC-TB, which is extensively drug-resistant TB, and that is resistant to even more key TB medicines. TB requirements require drugs taken together for 6 months or more, and when this process is interrupted or done incorrectly, the bacteria are exposed to suboptimal levels of medication, therefore allowing them to adapt and become resistant. I want to break this down in layman terms. So in other words, the drug becomes resistant when the bacteria itself is allowed to adapt to the drug. Because remember, for instance, you're supposed to take the drug for 6 months and you took it for 5 months or 4 months. Now it allows the drug, gives time for the drug to actually, gives time to the bacteria to now adapt. And therefore, whatever drug you're going to take in next, they've already, soldier up themselves against that antibiotic that you're going to provide. Hence, it's not going to be effective. Now, not completing the full TB treatment course, therefore, leads to TB bacteria multiplying slowly but very persistent. The full treatment course is designed to kill the bacteria at different stages of their life cycles. Now, if the treatment stops, some bacteria remain alive and can multiply again. Those surviving bacteria are the ones that were stronger or slightly less sensitive to the drugs. Now, over the time, this bacteria becomes fully resistant, making future treatment more difficult. So they become, it's sort of like they soldier up against the drug that you're going to give. However you give the drug, they become sort of like very stubborn soldiers. They will not die or they will not be combated with the antibiotic that you're going to give. Hence why it is very important, of utmost importance, to complete the entire course, even when one doesn't feel like it, as it's very critical. Now, missing doses or taking medications irregularly also contributes as TB treatment must maintain a steady level of drugs in the body. Now, when doses are missed, drug levels drop. The bacteria are not fully suppressed. Weak drug pressures allows the bacteria to mutate and survive. Irregular intake gives the bacteria repeated chances to learn how to resist the drugs. So consistent daily dosaging is necessary to completely kill or combat TB bacteria before they can adapt. Now, incorrect prescription or poor quality medicines also increase resistance of TB. Or TB resistance. Now, resistance can also form even when the patient tries their best if the wrong combination of the TB drug is prescribed and the dose is either too low or the medicines are expired or counterfeit or of poor quality. Hence, TB must be treated with at least 4 effective drugs initially to prevent its resistance. Now, if the bacteria are exposed to only 1 or 2 effective drugs, they can quickly become resistant to those drugs, because remember, they need, it's as if you're bringing in soldiers from the other end, and if only 2 of those soldiers are strong enough, they might not be able to counter the bacteria. Therefore, it would become resistant. So quality and correct prescriptions are very essential. They are essential parts of prevention. And now we have a scheduled commercial break coming up. We'll continue with this short informative education on TB drug resistance right after that commercial break. Stay tuned. This is On the Radar News Analysis.
Your popular $99 combo is back at YouSave. Get 1 kilogram of each Rice King rice, Top Score or Bokoma Super Maize meal, Sugar King white or brown sugar, 500 grams of Pasta Polana or Pasta King, and 750 milliliter Right Brand sunflower seed oil. That's 5 essential products for only 99 Namibian dollars. YouSave, I save. Yes, we all save at YouSave.
Again, on TB resistance, and we have heard, obviously, of maybe close ones, a neighbor, or how people contract tuberculosis or have TB, and then they have to be isolated, stay at a particular place on their own, and then we are told not to share the same cups and the same, you know, the same sauce, the same mugs, the same plates, and all that, so as to combat the bacteria from spreading from one person to the next. Now, also other aspects of why there's TB resistance is that of stopping treatment early when symptoms are improved. Now, I've mentioned this overall, speaking about antibiotics themselves, but now specifically related to TB resistance. Now, symptoms of TB, such as cough, fever, and weight loss, usually improve within a few weeks of treatment, but this does not mean the bacteria is gone. So stopping early is dangerous because many bacteria are only weakened and not dead. Now, this partially resistant bacteria multiply over time, which leads to MDR TB or XDR TB. Now, feeling better does not mean the infection is cured. It just means that it has been suppressed. And yeah. So inadequate support systems or lack of follow up also lead to TB resistance, such as TB treatment is long. Of course, TB treatment is long and it can be difficult, as patients may face long travel distances to clinics, lack of family or community support, side effects from the medication, which discourages a lot of people, finance or social barriers, and also when support is poor, for instance, patients miss appointments or skip dosages, they may stop treatment without understanding the risks that are involved, and they may also lose access to drugs altogether. So therefore, a strong healthcare support system is very essential to help people complete treatment effectively or correctly. Now, I have seen campaigns or sort of to say particular healthcare workers deliberately just dedicated to helping TB patients. So obviously to help them get better, and of course also to help prevent drug resistance. Now, low or inconsistent drug levels can also cause resistance as TB bacteria mutate naturally over time. Now, when treatment is inconsistent, drug levels fall to levels too low to kill the bacteria, but high enough to pressure bacteria to adapt. So this selective pressure kills the sensitive bacteria, but allows stronger mutated bacteria to survive. The surviving bacteria multiply and form a resistant strain. So the bottom line is that TB drug resistance is largely preventable. Now the key is ensuring correct drug combinations, that of course with your healthcare provider helping you. But then again, there's no harm in educating yourself on the type of drug or medication that you've been given. I mean, we have so many places now that we can search for information. I, on the other hand, almost any medication that I get, I am most likely to Google it. If I don't have access to the right books, I'm most likely to Google it and understand the side effects that come with it, so that if I'm feeling funny symptoms, I know it's because of the particular drug that I took, or I'm more likely also to see to search up my condition when I've already been to the hospital and I've been prescribed all this particular medication. Because remember, self-diagnosing is also very dangerous. So then I want to educate myself or read that pamphlet, that I will now educate myself to say, okay, so this is what, the indications of the drug is, or, indications by being the reasons why the drug is being given, the contraindications, being why the drug, should not be given in certain scenarios, precautions, things that you should be very cautious of when taking such particular drugs, and then the adverse effects or the side effects that come with this particular drug. So drug resistance is largely preventable with correct drug combinations, daily consistent intake of the medication, completion of the full course, and good support systems from family and friends, and of course quality medicines. Now, I want to believe that we do receive quality medications from our state hospitals. Now, proper treatment protects not just the patient, but the entire community, right? Yes, and that's the short, educative, informative, education on tuberculosis and why it can become drug resistant as we look at antimicrobial week or World Antimicrobial Awareness Week. And yeah, so now should you be interested in asking questions or contributions on this news analysis, dial in on studio. That is 083-288-401. That's the number in studio. 083-288-401. That's the number in studio. Now, one thing I do remember, back in school when they taught us about, drug resistance, especially TB drug resistance, when I was doing my community health, course, part of the modules, and did something that I really quite enjoyed. So hence why this, World Antimicrobial Awareness Week is also quite, something of importance to me, as it raises awareness to all of us. Now, I think I myself, and perhaps you, have been perhaps not very consistent with taking your antibiotics and finishing the course, or perhaps have been guilty of not ensuring that your children finish their antibiotics. Now today, I hope that you have learned the importance of finishing antibiotic course, and with not finishing it comes consequences of the bacteria gaining resistance and the antibiotic then not working. Now, that being said, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. This is On the Radar News Analysis. Like I said, the studio line is open, 083-288-401. I'll see you right after the news, after the commercial break.
Lipura nenge no wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe utite opoye ekukulile oshafafana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu kondado inawa nune uto otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi tayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijabo ili nawa ninge Pata fanona, Monica ko Eagle FM, onore tatu imwe bali heali, nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile ko berewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. And now for economic indicators before we bring you what's making headlines in terms of news beyond the borders of Namibia. Now on US dollar today, we'll get you 17.08 Namibian dollars. 1 Swiss franc is equals to 21 Namibian dollars and 44 cents. 1 euro is equals to 19 Namibian dollars and 80 cents. 1 United Arab Emirates dirham is equals to 4 Namibian dollars and 65 cents. 1 pound sterling is equals to 22 Namibian dollars and 45 cents. 1 Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 20 cents. And now we move over to trading economics. Now the yield on the US 10-year treasury note fell to 4.11% on Tuesday, the lowest level in about a week as a flight to safety and risk-off mood took hold amid renewed concerns over high valuations in technology and AI stocks, driving investors away from riskier assets. Now, traders also fear that new economic figures set to be released after the government shutdown could dent the Fed from further rate cuts, particularly as many policymakers have expressed skepticism about the need for additional easing. Now, the latest Labor Department data showed initial jobless claims at 232,000 for the week ended October 18, while continuing claims reached 1,957 million, which is the highest level since August. Now, the market currently assigns roughly a 46% probability of a 25 basis point reduction in the federal funds rate cut next week. Mauritius trade deficit narrows in September. Now, Mauritius trade deficit narrowed at 15.5 billion Mauritius rent in September 2025, and that is from 19.6 billion in the same month last year. Now, exports fell 3% year on year to 9.3 billion Mauritius currency, weighed down by steep declines in crude materials, in inedible expert fuels at minus 29.7%, animal and vegetable oils, fats and waxes at minus 33.3%, and chemicals and related products at minus 22.2%. Now, among key partners, exports to the United States sank 36%, dragged by the 10% reciprocal tariffs, while shipments to France dropped 20.2%. Meanwhile, imports fell 14.9% to 24.8 billion Mauritius currency. Belgium's construction output stalled year on year in September 2025, following an upwardly revised 7.3% growth in the previous month. Now, the stagnation was mainly due to lower output in the building construction at -2.5% versus 6.3% in August, and civil engineering at -2.3% versus 6.1%. Additionally, production growth slowed significantly for specialized construction activities at 1.3% versus 7.8%. Now, on a seasonally adjusted monthly basis, construction activity fell 1.1% in September, easing from a 1.6 drop in the preceding period. And that is what we had for you today in terms of economic indicators. Do stay tuned for news beyond the borders of Namibia right after the commercial break. We pause here now and take that commercial break. Now, remember, our studio line is very much open. You can still come through and air your opinions and contributions or ask questions right here on the Radar News Analysis. We'll see you right after the commercial break.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko dite opoye ekukulile. Oshafafana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu kwa ndado inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nukumuna oijamo ili nawa. Ninge pata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore tatu imwe mbali heali. Nola natu heali mbali no heali. Ile ko berewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Welcome back. For news beyond the borders of Namibia, let's start off in South Africa and a thorough discussion on factors that are driving cervical cancer in South Africa. Let's take a listen.
Started in Brazil. Brazil, of course, being the presidency last year of the to the venue where the G20 social summit is going to be taking place. This, of course, was started in Brazil. Brazil, of course, being the presidency last year of the G20. They brought about the social summit. South Africa continuing that social summit trajectory. And possibly one of the most important parts of the lead up to where the leaders are meeting this weekend, because this, as we described in the previous interview, is somewhat of the conscience of the leaders, because this is what civil society go through. This is what the average man on the street in these countries that are being spoken about go through. And this is where they put their issues to the fore. Now, quite an interesting one was obviously news coming out that we have seen and gotten wind of here, is that the United States notifying the G20 members that oppose a traditional leaders declaration at the 2025 summit in Johannesburg this weekend. Now, quite interesting, because we had that discussion about traditional leaders and what they were hoping for and how they are hoping that some of their lists and demands will also be, you know, taken to the leaders' summit, where, you know, something can come of it and you'll actually see this being ratified. But if it's left to the United States, they're saying absolutely not. They confirmed that the U.S. has written a letter to this effect. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of this one. But there are many other issues that are also under discussion here. And again, in the previous issue, the two issues that were brought up were education and health. And health is what we're going to focus on right now. My two guests that are going to help us unpack this, we've got Sipusiso Hlechwako, who is the public health expert at Health Systems Trust, and Lauren Pretorius, who is the CEO for Campaigning for Cancer. Of course, both civil society organizations, and talking to us about health and what people need. It's great to have you, and thank you so much for joining us on the program. Yeah. So let me begin with you, Sibusiso. If we look at the lead up to this, you know, there's a very strong focus in terms of inequality, sustainability and resilience. Those are what the themes are that South Africa have adopted. From a public health point of view, why is civil society involvement essential in the lead up to this?
Well, civil society represents the public, and basically they represent the challenges, particularly in public health, the challenges that you have mentioned, inequality and others, especially in public health. And one of the things that probably as civil society we're looking into is the issues around health. And for this, we're looking into cervical cancer, which is one of the priorities that South Africa has placed for its G20. So we've got an event that we're hosting today that's speaking to cervical cancer, and probably the question is why cervical cancer? It is one of the leading causes of death among women with cancers. About more than 6,000 women lose their lives every year in South Africa to cervical cancer. WHO has placed what we call targets, 90-70-90 targets, where you're saying 90% of girls under 15 should be vaccinated for cervical cancer, and 70% of women that are 35 or 45 should be screened for cancer, and 90% of the women that are diagnosed with cancer should receive treatment. So it is a critical issue, particularly in low and middle income countries and countries that are part of G20.
All right, interesting. Cervical cancer being right up there as one of those discussed, and an incredibly important one. Lauren, from your perspective, and particularly from a patient advocacy point of view, let's talk to shaping global health commitments and the agenda that you come from, particularly with regard to cancer as well.
So I think, Leanne, at the end of the day, we don't have anything without our health.
Yeah.
And I think that having a patient voice at the table and understanding what those needs and the lived experience are of patients is something we need to do, to take into policy and take forward. We're also seeing, over the years that there's a change in the types of diseases that are affecting societies, particularly with non-communicable diseases. So for us, it's really important that we start to shape policy and understand that these are the diseases that the man in the street is facing. As Siwasiso said, looking at cervical cancer, prostate cancer, heart disease, as well as diabetes.
And it's massive, because when you look around the world, I mean, inequality, I imagine, falls directly, or health falls directly under inequality. And I say this because we look at the inequality in healthcare systems, and that's something that we as a country grapple with, and I don't think we're alone to this. But perhaps we have lived experiences that we bring to the table that perhaps we can see changes happening there. Do you want to weigh in on that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, we have cervical cancer. It's one of those diseases that have been shown to be disproportionate according to economy, income, and places as well. So one of the things that we're hoping for G20 is emphasis on that it's a preventable disease, so no one should be dying from it. So things like early screening, early diagnosis, treatment are things that are critical and are things that can move the needle. It's things that will help in terms of as G20 countries grapple with issues. I think one of the other things that makes it important is in May at the World Health Assembly, South Africa actually rallied the world to recognize cervical cancer as an issue. And the 17th of November, which was yesterday, was marked as World Cervical Cancer Elimination Day. So I think as a country, South Africa is showing some leadership, but there is more that needs to be done. Our people in provinces, districts, communities, they need to be screened, they need access, and they need to get treatment as well.
I know your focus obviously is cervical cancer, but cancer in general, it's a big thing.
Yeah.
And this is where I bring you into the conversation even more now, because the bottom line is that access to healthcare is a basic human
the
right.
The United States government has initiated.
And it feels like we are not getting it. I mean, if you're living in a rural area, you're diagnosed with cancer, it's almost like a death sentence.
So I think, Leanne, there's that old adage, where I was born shouldn't determine whether I live. And I think that we're still seeing that. We haven't solved that problem.
Yeah.
There are efficiencies in the systems that we're not looking at. And if we looked at the lived experience of the patient, we need to make sure that the patient gets the right treatment at the right time with as few challenges as possible. And that means going to understand what the patient needs. And as decision makers, looking at those challenges, things like transport, things like the stigma that you experience in your society. 80% of South Africans will consult a traditional traditional healthcare practitioner before they go to a Western GP. That's something we need to take into account in our policy. And that's something that we can teach the world, because we aren't the only country that has alternate practitioners and health and cultural practitioners. These are things that we can teach the world and take forward our learnings into policy. Cancer in itself is, you know, there's a tidal wave coming,
yeah.
And we're not ready for it. We've been working for, to work for it, but there comes a responsibility, I think, at policy to look at it and to implement the policies that we've done. We've done good work on policies. We need to implement them. And then for the public to understand what are their risks, what are the signs and symptoms, and seek treatment early. The thing with cancer is if you get it early, your yeah. chances are better.
Yeah.
And, you know, that if you can take down one message today, you know, if there's something that's bothering you with your health or there's a symptom that won't go away, speak to someone who can help you get screened.
Yeah.
We'll do the work at the policy level, and the man on the street needs to look at those symptoms and find help.
Indeed. And yes, we do know that there are traditional healers, and I just can't help but thinking the US's stance on what traditional leaders and not voting for that. But the reality is how the world works. But I want to come to something that is vitally important as well. I mean, we know that in South Africa, we have the vaccination that obviously assists for cervical cancer, which is a major milestone in the development of medical care. However, there still is inequality when it comes to these major health companies out there, these pharmaceutical companies, where things are far too unaffordable for people to actually get the right treatment. What do you speak to about that? Because, you know, these are big things. I mean, we just have to take a pandemic into example and what happened during COVID. You know, these are things we need to avoid going forward. And I think you've said it yourself, there's a tidal wave coming, and cancer is a pandemic that is just seeming to be growing faster and faster. And more people I hear are unfortunately developing cancer. What do we do? How do we make this voice heard? I'm going to give each of you a moment to bring one pressing issue that if you had to speak to these leaders, what would you say to them?
Yeah, I think you've mentioned the issue of vaccines, HPV vaccines, and pricing. I think for me, first of all, there's a role that governments should play, but there's also a role and a responsibility for private sector in terms of ensuring that these medicines or these essential medicines that are needed, particularly for cancer, are made affordable. And that doesn't start at the end point. It starts from clinical trials, ensuring that our people are involved, and also ensuring that there is agreements in terms of pricing. And then it's the issues around procurement, and then it's the issues around actual manufacturing as well. As a continent, we need to be doing more. We need to be making more of the medicines that are needed by our people so that we make them in the long run more affordable. There are issues around regulatory as well in terms of making those easier so that it doesn't impact the end price that's then pushed down to the patients. But I think the bottom line and the rule of thumb is there is a responsibility for private sector to ensure that medicines, especially essential medicines, are made accessible and affordable for the people that need them.
Absolutely. When you hear the pricing of some of these medicines and cancer treatment, especially to just stay alive, you're looking and running into hundreds of thousand rands a month.
Yeah.
Now, people, yeah. We cannot afford that. What is your message you would leave with?
So my message is that innovation is needed in cancer. We don't have that, and we accept that innovation. But that innovation cannot cause more death. And we need to look at the value of that innovation and say, is this bringing value to the patient? Because at the end of the day, you can invest as much as you want in any innovation and trials in that. If it doesn't get to the patient, it's a waste of money. If it's not, if you, all that knowledge and expertise that was used to create that medicine, if the patient doesn't get it, we wasted that medicine.
Well, there you go. Thank you for talking to us here, and good luck. Good luck for these next few days, and let's get that message across, because this is an incredibly important conversation.
You know, the absence of the U.S. at the G20 being held in South Africa has not dented SA from going ahead with the G20 summit.
US has indicated that in their absence from the G20 summit in Johannesburg, they prefer that no G20 leaders declaration is adopted. The SAG 20 SOS Sherpa Ambassador Xolisa Mabongo told Full View that communication in this regard was received from the U.S. this weekend. South Africa will hand the G20 presidency over to the U.S.
The only country that is not in the room is the United States. And of course, that is also their choice not to be in the room. So far, we have not, we do not foresee any major challenges. We did receive over the weekend communication from the United States where they indicated that in their absence in the meeting, their preference is that there should be no declaration adopted. Mm-hmm. However, as the presidency of the G20, this does not depend on us. We are the president, but the G20 is made up of 19 countries, plus the European Union and the African Union. Mm-hmm. So as the presidency, therefore, we are guided by the views of all G20 members. So you cannot, no country can just make an appeal to the presidents and say, I'm not in your meeting, so don't have a declaration. Mm-hmm. But we have not really had any challenges with that in the meeting that started yesterday.
Let's unpack this now with Dr. Stembile Mbete, the Executive Director of the Public Affairs Research Institute. Dr. Mbete, good evening. Thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate it. This is an interesting moment in that multilateralism is facing its first crisis of consensus, it seems. Maybe not its first, but certainly one that involves South Africa at a grand scale. Talk to us about what the implication of this could potentially be on the G20 declaration.
Well, I think we must be a bit cautious in those kinds of grand statements. I mean, multilateralism has faced many crises of consensus over the last year in particular. You know, we've seen how the UN systems have basically collapsed because of the United States' intransigence. We've seen that happen in the United Nations Security Council in particular several times over the last decade. So I think that this isn't a particularly unique crisis in multilateralism. It is, however, a very big crisis, I think, for the G20 itself. So the G20, unlike the United Nations, unlike the World Bank, for example, or the IMF, is a club. It's an informal international, it's not an organization as such. It's a club of members, the 19 states and then the African Union and the European Union. And it works on an informal set of rules. And one of those rules is that decisions are taken by consensus. And so at the end of each year of the G20 at the leaders' summit, that there's a leaders' declaration, and that leaders' declaration is adopted by all the leaders that are in the room, and then it is communicated to the public. And within that declaration, it's a consolidation of all the decisions that have been made by all the different working groups through all the different meetings that have taken place in the year. And even if countries may disagree with some of the decisions that have been taken over the course of the year, the understanding is that they'll come to a common agreement and they will communicate this declaration that they all just generally agree with most of it, even though none of the decisions of the G20 are binding. So no country is compelled or forced to implement everything that is said or spoken about in the declaration, but it's always been, since the summit meeting started in 2008, that at the end of a year of G20 meetings, there is this leader's declaration that reflects at least outwardly some kind of consensus amongst the G20 members. And this year is going to be the first year since the G20 summit meeting started in 2008 that you're likely not to have that kind of leaders' declaration, and instead will have a chair's statement, which is a statement by the president of the G20, in this case South Africa, that will then have all of the decisions that have been taken over the course of the year that won't necessarily be backed by all the members of the G20, in this case, including the United States and Argentina. It is, of course, completely possible for the countries of the G20 that will be here for the member states to pass a leaders' declaration with, you know, say to the United States, well, and Argentina, you weren't in the room, and we're going to decide to make this leader's declaration anyway, but I think that's highly unlikely given the politics at the moment.
So the absence of the U.S. is unimpactful? Is that a fair statement?
No, the absence of the U.S. is impactful because it does mean that the kind of processes that have always backed the G20 and enforce the G20's legitimacy are weakened, right, if you don't have the United States in the room. However, it doesn't mean that the decisions that have been made over the course of the year won't still be adopted in some form and that countries won't continue implementing those decisions. Remember also that the very important part of the G20 Leaders Summit is all the bilateral meetings and all the meetings that happen in the background between different countries, and the U.S. not being around for those, I think, is a significant disadvantage for the U.S. because decisions are going to be made without it being there.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there, Dr. Mbete. Thank you so much for your time.
The U.S. and Zambia discuss a $1.5 billion U.S. dollar health grant.
The United States government has initiated talks with Zambia to sign a memorandum of understanding that will improve Zambia's health sector. The MOU, through a grant worth $1.5 billion U.S. dollars, will run from April 2026 to 2030. Health Minister Elijah Mchima disclosed in Lusaka that the MOU will be signed in December this year. This was during a high-level meeting held in Osaka on new grant assistance from the U.S. government to support Zambia's health systems and services.
This support should provide relief to Zambia in early years of this MOU to enable the country to increase domestic resources to take over the funding of all activities in 2030. Program will focus on strengthening the health systems with a particular attention to one human resources for the health, laboratory capacities, stimulating local manufacturing, epidemic and pandemic preparedness, reducing the burden of HIV, TB, and malaria, and above all, integrating the management of disease of the program level.
And U.S. Ambassador to Zambia, Michael Gonzalez, says the partnership will deliver tangible health systems and sustainable results for both countries.
This plan, starting together at the same table at step one, will allow us to plan a gradual transition from intensive U.S. government funding to increased Zambian government funding, full ownership, and most importantly, the sustainable support of the health services that the Zambian people expect and deserve.
And U.S. Department Senior Health Advisor Brad Smith says the MOU has potential to improve Zambia's health sector.
We really see this as a new day in our partnership and a new way of thinking about how we work together. The commitments that we're making or considering making on the budget side are significant. On a per capita basis, when you look at the disease burden, is our highest commitment in all of Africa. So we view this as a very important partnership with a lot of potential.
The MOU envisions both governments' commitment to funding levels and health outcomes performance objectives to expedite the transition from an AIDS-dependent health sector to a Zambian government-led health system. This will ensure that Zambia's health system is able to sustainably meet the health needs of its people. Onesta Mshoka, ZMBC News, Lusaka.
Jumia forecast strong growth amid Black November and holiday shopping season. Let's take a listen.
Firm Jumia reported a 25% rise in revenues for the quarter ending in September. Well, management is confident that it will continue trimming losses and break even by the end of 2026. In the 9 months ending in September, the firm's revenues were up 5% to $127.5 million. The firm reported an 8% rise in operating losses at $52.6 million and a 37% drop in pre-tax losses to $50.4 million. Jumia's management is also forecasting pre-tax losses of $50.55 million for the year 2025 and $25 to $30 million for 2026. It estimates that the retailer will be profitable in 2027. Now, of course, after exiting South Africa and Tunisia in late 2024, Jumia has doubled down on its core markets. The number of quarterly active clients in Q3 rose by 17% to 2.4. There were more than 15.1 million goods ordered on the platform in the 9 months to September. That is 24% higher year on year. Meanwhile, the gross merchandise value for the 9 months rose 5% to $539.1 million. Meanwhile, over in Nigeria and Egypt, order volumes rose by 30% and 37% respectively. Well, Jumia is forecasting order growth rates of at least 25% this year, with a strong performance in the fourth quarter, of course, boosted by 4 weeks of Black November sales and the holiday season. Well, CGTN's Raman Yang explored that outlook with the firm's CEO, Francis Dufay. Let's take a listen.
We're not opening new markets in the short term. We believe that we have huge potential in the existing markets, right? The current markets like Nigeria, Kenya, Egypt, Morocco, Ghana, and so on are still largely underpenetrated, even by our own standards, comparing with our best performing countries within the company. So we can do a lot more volumes. We can serve many, many more customers in those key markets to start with. And then the plan to get to profitability lies, of course, on strong top-line growth, and we see that it's happening, right? Last quarter, we grew our volumes by 25% year-over-year on a like-for-like basis in hard currency, and also continued improvement of our efficiencies and cost management.
The number of quarterly active clients also went up by quite a bit, comparing Q3 25 to Q3 24, up by over 20% to about 2.4 million. But the other thing that stood out for me looking at your numbers is that 60% of your orders are now coming from outside the main urban areas in the countries you operate in, Nigeria, Ghana, Kenya, and so on and so forth. Is that going to be powering the next wave of growth and spending on Jumia platforms?
Well, that's not the only thing, but that's a very important strategic priority for us, right? We started from the realization several years back that unfortunately in our markets, on our continent, business leaders have a tendency to underestimate demand from smaller cities and from upcountry regions. And when we went on the ground, met customers, we realized there's demand and there's purchasing power in smaller towns as well. People have income from agriculture, farming, and a number of small businesses. But they have nothing to buy, right? Local supply, the local retail network is usually pretty bad in those cities. So we've built the right logistics model so we can go and serve those customers out there with the same highly competitive, well-priced, good quality products that we have in the capital cities of Lagos, Dakar, Nairobi, or Cairo. It's going to continue, right? We're not at the end of this trend. So you see that the ratio of packages shipped to smaller towns is increasing every quarter.
I got the impression, just looking at the conversations you had on the analyst call after the results came out, I got the impression that the argument you also made to them was, look, our logistics expertise is essentially a sort of moat for Jumia, even though you've got, you know, entrants like Shein and Temu coming into some of these markets, Nigeria, Kenya, and so on and so forth. But my reading of what you said was, look, our logistics expertise essentially is what'll give us an edge vis-a-vis all of these entrants from outside the continent.
So Rama, I think it's definitely the right reading. Thank you. That's the right conclusion. We believe that we have deeply adapted e-commerce business model to customers and vendors and partners in our markets across Africa. And this level of adaptation is actually very hard to replicate for any foreign company coming to, I don't know, Nigeria or Morocco or Kenya with a very standard, rigid playbook that worked at scale in Europe or in the US or in China. It's actually very hard to just copy paste it to Uganda or Kenya. Very hard.
Walk us through the supply situation that you have at the moment, because, you know, you constantly spoke about improvements in the quality of supply, getting products from markets in Asia, for example, coming into markets here in Africa. And the impression I got is that, you know, we did have some supply chain issues 2 years ago, 3 years ago, but that has largely been sorted out now. Is that the correct reading of it?
Well, it's never fully sorted, right? I mean, supply is a topic of constant attention. We always aim to bring better products at better prices for our customers. What has happened, though, is that it's massively improved. First of all, the macroeconomic situation is helping us in a way. The currency stability is enabling importers to do their jobs, right, without taking too much risk. So there's a lot more supply on our marketplace. The recent pivot from Chinese manufacturers to new markets is putting Africa back on the map. So we don't have to fight that hard anymore. So we can get more supply, more products at better prices for our customers. And we really see that in the numbers. We see that the quality of the assortment is improving. The price points are better and better. The repurchase rate of our customers, the loyalty is increasing, and the satisfaction surveys are now at an all-time high. So we really see the impact across our whole platform.
When you say you're not having to fight as hard as you used to in the past, you know, to get to convince these Chinese manufacturers to pay attention to markets, say, in Africa, can you give us a bit more detail on that? What used to happen in the past?
Well, I think over the past 3 years, if you take just the past 3 years, first of all, there was a lot of currency volatility in key markets, Egypt, Kenya, Nigeria, Ghana, for example. And when that happens, international suppliers are a bit fearful, right? They don't want to commit large inventory to countries where there might be significant FX downgrade. They don't know how much money they will get 6 or 12 months later. So that's one. There was really a lot of suppliers being scared of shipping more goods to Africa and taking more foreign exchange risk. And second, Africa was seen as a relatively small and less attractive market. Now that things are becoming a bit more tighter with the US, we really see with our Chinese partners and international partners in general, a desire to diversify and to look at other markets as well. It's not just the US. And that gives a bit more attention to Africa. It's putting us back on the radar, and we're thus able to secure more supply for our customers.
DRC Congo bans foreigners from small retail to boost local businesses.
Rwanda sells clothes at Kinshasa's busy Zando market. Business has been slow lately, but he hopes that will soon change after the government barred foreigners from operating small retail shops.
I'm launching a strong appeal to our Minister of Commerce to implement that decision, because nowadays we have Lebanese who are selling caps and belts in retail just like us.
A law enacted way back in 1973 reserved small-scale trade for Congolese citizens, but past administrations failed to enforce it, allowing foreigners to enter the retail trade. Many locals now welcome the new enforcement drive.
It's a good decision because foreigners have killed our business. We trade in small quantities, but they are now selling the same things as us. They should be engaged in the wholesale trade.
Some foreign traders who declined to speak on camera argued that the decision violates the East African Community Treaty, which promotes the free movement of labor across member states.
The EEC Common Market Protocol is actually trying to let people be free and work in a free zone. It's a fact, but we also have so many laws. There is no confusion. There are laws emphasizing on the fact that each country has a kind of area, protected area.
The DRC joined the 8-member regional bloc in 2022, pledging to uphold its key principles. Some experts say the move to protect local businesses is commendable, but it should not be rushed.
The government ought to support local investors who want to run the market. Today, most of our sectors are controlled by expatriates. Take the example of the automobile industry, which is dominated by Nigerians. We cannot expect Congolese traders to start running such sectors in the next couple of days after the foreigners leave.
Political instability, corruption, and conflicts in the DRC have caused widespread poverty across the country, forcing many citizens to carry out odd jobs to survive. Some foreigners have invested massively in the mining sector, but others are in the retail trade, which the government is now planning to reserve for its nationals.
The government's plan to stop foreigners from engaging in petty trade has upset many of them operating in this busy market in Kinshasa. Authorities now plan to pass a new law that will outline the trade categories reserved for foreigners in order to promote local entrepreneurship.
Now, with that being said, we have come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Reading News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the Uncle Nana Dengue program brought to you by Lucy Shimi. From Indafa, happy Juju, it is goodbye and have yourself a wonderful Tuesday afternoon ahead.